I'm Dave Freund, and this is The Next Page. And we are still flying without Marissa, but we wish Marissa well and look forward to having her back. And I have a special guest with me this morning. I am here with my dad, Bob Freund. Dad, welcome.
Thank you.
Glad you're here. And you asked me a question yesterday. You said, you know, what in the world are we going to talk about? So I've given you some questions. So you have been in manufacturing, or when did you start in manufacturing? What year?
1949. Right.
As an apprentice at Westinghouse?
Not yet.
Not yet.
No. Because I had most of my credits to graduate when I entered the senior year, I was able to take the last half of the senior year and go to work in a factory.
Okay. What did you do?
Actually, I worked as a machinist, hoping someday that I would get into Westinghouse's training school for tool and die makers, which happened about 6 or 8 months later.
Okay. So, you know, growing up, you grew up on a dairy farm.
Yes.
In Mansfield, Ohio, outside Mansfield, Ohio. But you were born in Brooklyn.
That's true. I don't boast about that usually, because I was 2 years old when my father went back to Ohio to be the farmer he always wanted to be.
Okay, so let's quickly talk about why was Grandpa in Brooklyn as a farmer?
Grandpa married my mom, who was a businesswoman in Brooklyn. She helped her father, who had no sons, run a knitting mill, small knitting mill, and was very capable at it. So when she married my father, she convinced him to go to Brooklyn and learn the knitting business. He was the oldest of 10 children. Actually, my Aunt Sophie was older, but the oldest son of 10 children. And he worked in a factory to help support his siblings. And the younger ones helped his father run a farm.
So
his background was farming.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and he, you know, because I've heard some of the stories, but so he ends up in, so the farmer from Central Ohio ends up in Brooklyn.
Yes.
Running a knitting mill.
Right.
Was he any good at business, or was it all grandma?
Well, he was a quick learner, but it was pretty much his wife, my mother, that taught him all he ever knew about business.
So you're born in Brooklyn in 1932, and so what was it, 1934, 35?
34.
You move back to Mansfield,
right,
Ohio, or outside of Mansfield, Ohio. Right. So how does this young, up-and-coming dairy farmer end up in manufacturing?
Actually, my father already had his second farm. His first farm he had to sell because he was diabetic, and insulin was a brand new thing.
Okay.
And he literally was wasting away, and the doctor told him, don't come back anymore, because one of these days you'll be up in the peach orchard, he said, and your wife will be a widow, and your two little boys orphans. And so my father began to take insulin, but he had already sold the farm, his first farm, and then in 6 months he was the strapping fellow he always was, and purchased the second farm.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what were some unique things about the second farm?
It was really quite a famous place. It was part of the Underground Railway system. It was known as the Finney Farm. And Finney was an abolitionist and made sure that the slaves got into Canada once they got as far as, he was one of the last stations in Ohio.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And I remember you talking about a trap door.
Yes.
Off the kitchen, was it?
Yes, in the laundry room of the farmhouse. And it was a crawl space about 4 feet deep.
Yep.
Totally. And where if he got word from his hands, farm hands, that people were coming.
Bounty hunters.
Bounty hunters up the lane, why he would put them in the slave cellar.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Until the bounty hunters were gone or occupied somehow, and then they would leave and rush out. I love one of the stories that you tell about, and this can be verified on the internet if you do a search of the Finney farm, but that one time, well, why don't you tell it, the time when he had the runaways in the cellar,
right,
hiding them, and the bounty hunters came.
Yes. There were, according to records, there were three bounty hunters that came, and Finney said very quickly to his farmhands, "I'm going to have my house lady, or his wife, whomever it was, serve them a meal, and while we're having the meal, be as quiet as you can and load them into a load of hay." And the cellar was actually in the next room,
yep,
behind the door. And so it was that Finney had a prayer that went on and on and on until the wagon was loaded and down the road a piece. And these three fellows thought something was going on, but in deference to the man who was praying, they stayed in their chairs.
So it was a long prayer while the runaways were able to get out.
And it was known thereafter that everyone that knew about it, and quite a few people did, that went, and prayer was wont to be made frequently at a dinner table by many people.
Yeah.
And if the prayer was long, that someone would say, "Boy, that was a real Finney, wasn't it?"
That's great. Great story. So now you're at the second farm.
Yeah.
A nice farm from the pictures that I've seen.
Yes.
So why did you end up, what attracted you to manufacturing?
I had an uncle who had a 9-inch South Bend lathe in his garage.
Wow.
That really I was fascinated with.
Okay.
I would stand for hours and watch him run that whenever I could do that. And I think my father realized that my heart wasn't in farming. My brother couldn't be a farmer because he had allergies that had to cover his mouth every time and nose every time he went in the barn.
Okay.
So father decided, I think I was 14 or 15 years old, he said, "You know, son, if you're not going to farm, your brother can't. This is a great time to sell it." And it was after the war. People had money.
Yep.
And looked for ways to
spend it.
Yeah.
Okay. And the interesting thing is that you can't find that farm if you go look for it anymore.
No.
What did the farm property become?
It became a housing project.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if that even exists anymore. It ultimately, General Motors built a huge factory right across the road, Route 30, from the farm. And I think the fellow who bought the farm didn't intend to farm it.
Okay.
Had his ear to the ground, as it were, and made it a...
And it someday ended up being neighbor to a big GM plant,
exactly.
A Fisher Body plant.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about, what are some of your most outstanding memories of being in it? So you did end up getting awarded an apprenticeship at Westinghouse. Tell us a little bit about the apprenticeship and a little about Westinghouse.
Okay. Westinghouse back then was over 5,000 people. 5,600,
wow.
I think, people was their peak. And they had converted back to peacetime production.
Okay.
They needed every 2 years in order to expand the retirement situation that these old-time toolmakers were retiring. They took 12 young men every 2 years into their apprentice school. And it was well-known school. And a certified program was 2,000 hours, which is 4 years, basically. We even had instruction in engineering drawings and that sort of thing, and tool and die design from an engineer there. And we finished early because once we really got the hang of things, because we were probably the cheapest help they had, we worked a lot of overtime. So I was done and certified by the state of Ohio probably in 3.5 years.
Okay, so it was really 2,000 hours per year, typically over 4 years,
right.
being a total of 8,000 right. hours. Very similar to New York's apprentice programs.
Yes.
Okay. Sure. So, small town, maybe 20,000 people.
Maybe a few more than that.
Maybe 30. That yeah, maybe 30,000. Okay, at the time, but a factory of 5,600 people. So, how big was that in terms of floors or footprint? Do you think
it was probably five buildings that were four stories high?
Wow! And what did they make?
Mostly appliances.
Okay.
After they had a plant in Columbus also, and after it was converted back to peacetime production, all the refrigerants, freezers mm-hmm. and refrigerators
yep.
were made in Columbus. But we still made washers, dryers,
okay.
and small appliances, a lot of them.
I remember as a kid, every time the washing machine broke, you just seemed to know how to fix it. And I never figured out why you knew how to fix it till I realized you probably worked on the prototypes for some of those.
Yes, yes.
So, what's one of the biggest dyes you ever worked on?
It probably was a dye for a refrigerator body.
Okay.
It was probably, I'm guessing... 6 feet by 8 feet.
Wow.
Yeah.
6 foot by 8 foot die. And so for the folks listening that have no idea what a die is, because they think that dyes are things that we put in somebody's hair or into beverages, but a die is a metal stamping tool.
Yes.
To form probably the outer wrappers or the doors for refrigerators.
Yes.
That's amazing. So you start out as a tool and die maker at Westinghouse. You end up in the prototype.
Well, in the engineering lab.
Okay.
Yeah.
What does that entail?
Well, after a toolmaker was a journeyman mm-hmm. and had his papers, the opportunity of getting onto anything other than a second or third shift was about 20 years down the road.
Okay.
And the children were very small. And while I worked, they slept, and conversely, mm-hmm. when I wanted to sleep, you didn't.
Right.
And so I missed many of the church functions.
Okay.
Particularly, choir practice.
Yeah.
I loved to sing. Back in those days, I could. Anyway, they, had an opening in the engineering lab, and a fellow, church member worked in that engineering lab, and he came over and said, "Bob, why don't you come and talk to my boss? He's looking for somebody like mm-hmm. you." And so I did, and I went to work there, and that was an 8-to-5 job until I left Westinghouse in 65.
So as the tool maker, tool and die maker in an engineering lab, you were paired with an engineer and probably a draftsman?
Yes, ultimately, that's what happened. They worked as a team.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So how does the die maker, tool and die maker from Ohio end up in Syracuse?
I had become a minister in the church and had done a lot of evangelical ministry around North America, mm-hmm. United States and Canada. And there were times when I had difficulty getting back from a weekend of ministry to be on the job at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
And I really needed to find what ultimately was called flex time.
Sure.
Back then it wasn't, but something that when I worked on a project and it was done, I could be free to go in 10 days.
Yep. So you ended up being invited or being offered a position by somebody here in Syracuse.
Yes.
To move
yes.
from Ohio, and that would give you the flexibility you needed for your,
exactly.
your ministry work.
Yeah.
So when you came to Syracuse, what job did you have?
I worked in, first of all, the company, Textile Marking Machine Company, was a young company that made marking machines for the laundry industry. And they realized that they needed to automate that equipment and had a contract, I think, with a cash register company. I'm not which one. I don't remember which one. That we worked to automate those machines.
Okay.
And the first place that the that they had in the little factory just didn't have the machinery that I needed to do what they wanted me to do.
Sure.
So I worked up at Patel
Industry
Machine Shop that was just a gorgeous place for quite some time until the prototypes that we were working on were done and proven.
Mm-hmm.
And then because I had a tool-making experience, unfortunately, I needed to go down to textile marking and work together in tooling up these new ideas. And I left Tom Patel, whom I really, really enjoyed working for. Yeah.
And that was a nice little tool shop that was on Ball Circle in between Ainslie and Brighton Ave.
Right.
On that little loop there. And it became Advanced Hone and Grinding before they ended up moving out of that area. But when I was at Selflock, I was right around the corner from that. So how long were you at Textile Marking? It was sold out, right? It became Texmark?
It became Texmark. It was purchased by another company that had labeling machines also. However, they embroidered their labels.
Okay.
And Textile Marking Machine had become so good at printing labels that if you held both at arm's length, you had a hard time knowing what. And so a company from Grand Rapids, you know, if you can't lick them, join them.
Yep.
So they bought the company.
Okay.
And their machine division was brought here.
Okay.
Into Syracuse's operation too.
Okay. And so what was you ended up being a plant manager?
Director of manufacturing.
Director of manufacturing for Texmark, which was a subsidiary of Rosepatch.
Right.
So, but you didn't stay there. What happened?
In the late 70s, there was an energy crisis. And the state decided they needed some kind of a board that if that energy crisis occurred again, or one later on, that this board would allocate who got what when.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on that board representing small industry.
Okay.
And Jim Schneider, who was the president of MACNIC at that time, it wasn't called MACNIC, it was called the Manufacturers Association, asked me once to stay after a board meeting. He said, I got something I want to show you. And he showed me an application for someone that could become a coordinator for business and education, as it were, for the State Department of
Education.
Education, yes, in Albany. And when I thought about it afterwards, I said to your mother, I said, boy, he said, I want you to proof this. And I said to your mom, I'd really love to do this. She said, go to it. And I realized only afterwards that Jim had set me up for that. And probably there weren't going to be many takers.
Right.
And so I left Textile Marking Machine, or Texmark as it was, and began to work in the school community to try to convince them that there were some good paying jobs that were going begging out in the community.
Sure.
And ultimately, the Community Council on Careers was formed.
Yep.
And what was supposed to be a year's project ended up 5 exciting years. Yep. I really, really enjoyed it. And we had over 200 job sites where seniors that had most of their credits and were loafing through their senior year because they could visit these sites and see exactly what the careers were all about. And that was really an exciting thing to see, how young people could be amazed at going into industry and see, or to a veterinarian office and see what really happened.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I remember because I was in high school toward the tail end of your time with the Community Council on Careers, and And there was these like explorer posts or something were all over the place.
Yes.
And we did these assessments. And believe it or not, when I did my assessment, the answer came back that I should go into agriculture. So it would have been interesting because the first place I went to was Agway's research center out in Apulia. And it would have been interesting had I gone back into dairy farming. But when I talked with the dairy farmer who no longer farms up here in Navarino, the question we asked him was, what's the best way to get into dairy farming? And he said, I have three daughters. So, but anyways, I didn't go into agriculture. But the last thing that you did, if I remember it right, was set up the Industrial Trades Institute.
Exactly.
So what was that?
Sid Johnson was superintendent of schools.
Mm-hmm.
And he was interested in the community council careers. And he called me up once and he said, Bob, I want you to come and I'm going to show you something. And Central Tech had probably one of the nicest machine shops I had ever seen.
Yeah, it did. I was in there.
And two young men were working, were learning mm-hmm. in there. He said, this just can't go on. These machines should all be running. So what working together with Jim and Sid Johnson, we found two tool and die makers who also had teaching degrees. And we ran that machine shop two shifts a day. For those who wanted to learn and couldn't give up their mm-hmm. jobs, they could go second shift.
Yep.
Those who had a job paid, I think, $2,000 for the X number of months, I don't mm-hmm. remember. And those who didn't, inner city kids, could have it free.
Sure.
And they all got a toolbox full of precision tools.
Yep.
And it really worked very, very well. Your good friend,
Dirk Cook,
went through that program.
And then we hired him as an apprentice toolmaker.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the State Department gave, I think, a year or 18 months credit towards
wow, that's
tool
awesome.
Making. Yeah, by taking that particular
that's huge.
Program. And that lasted about 10 years.
Okay.
The other interesting thing was, I think on the fourth or fifth summer, the program wasn't funded anymore by the state.
Mm-hmm.
It was funded by industry, actually,
yep.
business and industry. And I can't remember the fellow's name, but he was the in charge of the education department in Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
knew what I was doing.
Yep.
And he came and asked me if I wanted a job for the summer. And I said, well, I would take one offered. And the interesting thing was, having gone from a school system that I had really a hard time breaking into,
yeah,
all school systems, Laura Hand was my, who still is on
Channel 3.
She really was my advocate. She'd go wherever I was and take pictures and see an empty audience, you know,
right.
whatever. Anyway, Brunswick, Georgia had an academy that was the oldest federated school system in America.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn Academy. I can remember the name. And they had no trade school.
Wow.
And what was happening to their young people was when they graduated, they went down south to Savannah
mm-hmm.
and took a job when jobs went begging in Brunswick. And so over the course of 6 months, I developed a cadre of teachers
okay.
who were going to be advocates for these companies to become their trade school.
Wow.
I don't know how long that worked, but it worked for quite a few years. They didn't need a vocational school because the community was
sure.
the school. And that was very hard up here, at least, for guidance counselors who were taught to send everybody to college.
Sure.
Had a hard time breaking into.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I find it so interesting because, you know, after you, at some point, Joe Vargo picks up Partners for Education and Business.
Right.
Is now affiliated with MACNY, and that now we are entering our second year, I believe, or third year at MACNY, running, helping coordinate apprentice programs mm-hmm. for the state, for our members throughout the state. And if I'm not mistaken, I think we have over 100 apprentices now.
That's great.
In the program. But Martha Ponge and Megan do a great job with that. So at some point, you go back into manufacturing.
Yes.
So if I remember it right, it was probably 74 to 79 you worked for the state, in essence.
Yes. Yes.
As someone that BOCES gave tenure to, which I saw a newspaper article about that, which I thought, or a letter, which I thought was humorous. So what brought you back into manufacturing?
I really intended to make this an interim job anyway. And it was the most exciting thing that I ever did. But a friend of ours bought a business in Auburn, and he said, I'm interested in having you. I worked for him, and he was vice president of Texmark.
Right.
And he asked me if I would come and run his factory in Auburn. And at that point in time, the Industrial Trades Institute was just in, we were laying the first blocks of the foundation of that operation. And I said, I just can't go, at least for the next 6 months. And in fact, Jim forbade me to go. So 6 months later, then, when the institute was up and running, I went to Auburn to work there.
Okay. And where did you work last in manufacturing?
The last job that I had in manufacturing was at Jaquith Industries.
Okay. What did you do for Jaquith?
I was director of manufacturing there first, and then ultimately vice president of the company. And then Don Jaquith passed away shortly after that. And I decided to retire at 62, and you still could do that back in those days.
Okay.
You youngsters are going to have to work longer than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I like to remind people that retirement is getting up and doing what you want to do.
Yes.
So if you love what you do, you must be retired. And I think I'm already retired at 57, but.
Yes. And I was thankful. I had been an instructor at MACNE, I think right around when 1987, I started at Jaquith. And I think even a little before that, I was teaching their program.
I think if I look back, it was probably the mid-70s you started teaching supervisory leadership.
Yes. I don't know what they called it then.
Which is exactly the same title we use today.
Is that right?
It is. So how did that start?
I don't recall, but I know it started at the talk about it started at the Central Technical High School thing.
Okay.
When that became the institute.
The Industrial Trades Institute.
Yeah, the Industrial Trades Institute. And I remember teaching a couple of classes at Central Tech.
Mm-hmm.
And then, went to MACNE to teach and design some of their help design some of their programs for them. And I did that until I was 5 years ago when I was 81 years old.
Yeah, I just did the math here. So you started teaching at MACNE, teaching supervisory leadership. Right. If you started in 1974, which my guess is it was either 74 or 75. Because I remember you talking about it, and you retired from that at 81. You taught for 38 or 39 years.
Well, I was 81 years old.
When you stopped.
When I stopped.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So one of the amazing things, if you think about that, is, and you know, I started training at MACNE in 95 when you wanted to go to Florida in the winter and you needed somebody to fill in a few sessions. So that's how I started. But for 38 or 39 years, you were training supervisors in Syracuse. And I know for a fact, because I've spoken to some of these now CEOs of our member companies, they say, I remember taking supervisory leadership from your dad. Now, I also had the privilege of working for you at a company in Auburn for 7 years. But you did things that nobody did. And one of the things that I remember was, and when I was at SelfLock, I brought you in to set up our self-directed work teams. But how did you come up with an idea of a self-directed? Nobody was writing about this in books yet.
I realized when I was still in manufacturing, working even as a toolmaker at Westinghouse, that everything was micromanaged.
Okay.
An example of that really offended me. I was working on a team. The engineer was a great guy, and we actually had developed a sweeper together, mm-hmm. the three of us. And I think it was a sweeper, I don't remember, but a minor appliance, not a major appliance. And when it came time for the patents mm-hmm. to be listed, the engineers listed came and said to me, these, as far as I'm concerned, these were your ideas. He said to the drafter, John, you know, these were your ideas and I'll take credit for the rest. And because there was an engineer at the at the helm of Westinghouse mm-hmm. at that time, he refused to accept this
wow.
engineer. And they actually lost one of the best engineers they had, who went to Massachusetts
wow.
to work for a company. I don't remember which one. I went to New York shortly afterwards mm-hmm. and John went across the street to the Tap and Stove Company.
Okay.
Lost the whole team. And it was just the wrong way of doing things, you
okay.
know, compartmentalizing everything, micromanaging everything.
Mm-hmm.
And even when I was at Jaquith, I still realized that I was doing too much of that. When I would go on vacation for a couple of weeks, and I would take five of my department heads and say, you know, you make these decisions while I'm gone, and the things that need my attention, put in this basket, and I'll be back in a week or 10 days. Well, the basket was half full, and I thought, whoa, whoa, Freud, this is wrong. If you have enough confidence in these leaders to make some of these decisions, the five of them are going to decide what's in the basket
sure.
a whole lot better than you
right.
can. And I finally, and your mother would attest to this, I finally was able to go on vacation, not just go to a place.
Right. Right.
And worry about what was happening in the
yeah.
factory. And so that was my premise all
okay.
along. Find the right people, gather them together, give them direction, give them responsibility
yeah.
to fulfill the responsibilities that I ought to be planning better for.
Sure.
While they really run the shop, as it were.
Okay, so you're moving the decisions to the level of the people that know what's going on.
Exactly.
And as the leader, you set the strategic direction.
Exactly.
Interesting. So I also remember stories about when you were working at Jaquith and you had to find a way to reduce the cost
yes.
in some product. How did you do that?
I really had a very good relationship with the auto
UAW local.
Yeah. I said to them, to the managers, a year before, I wrote a program that said, we really need to cost reduce this, because anybody that finds a way to make money, they will, and they'll undersell you
mm-hmm.
so that they get the business. And that happened. Jaquith was making laundry equipment for G.A. Braun.
Mm-hmm.
And they had, when I went there, they had orders for the next year.
Okay.
And then all of a sudden it was 6 months. And then it was a month. And then it was hand to mouth.
Sure.
And a year before it got hand to mouth, I said, what we need to do, and I knew that there was money that was left to be found
sure.
in these machines. Because after break time, I'd have to wake some of the guys up from their barca loungers
mm-hmm.
to go back to work. So I actually was able to convince the union leadership
mm-hmm.
because they were going from just mediocre jobs
sure.
to mediocre jobs
from
high-priced welders
sure.
back that were welding actually a stainless steel sheet
right.
to one-inch carbon steel.
Yep.
I mean, these guys were artists, and now they're making pocket money.
Sure.
Because it was an incentive shop.
Yep.
Notwithstanding, we were down to four welders.
Okay.
And the union said, okay, let's do this. And management decided, no. That's not according to our side of the contract. And a year passed. And they were just about out of Braun business. And Don Jakewood came back in. He was a pretty sick man about then. And he went to lunch with the fellow who was running the business, the chief operating officer, and came back and said, you know, Bob, we're going to do this thing. And actually, we needed to get 10% out of it. And I ran into the union brick wall when I said, I'm going to choose the welders, not you. I'm going to choose the welders. And I picked two of the best welders that we had. And we built two of every type of product that we made for Braun. And they simply had to look for cost reduction in that. They actually even changed their whole back room to where they could have jib cranes and pick up their part. Anyway, we were able to do that and got all that work back before you went to Jakewood.
Right.
And they actually were running a second shift when you went to Jakewood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the neat part that I like about that story, and I heard about it when, you know, you were out of Jakewood before I got there. But when I went there was that, you know, it was the union workers sitting down with the salaried engineers, oftentimes over lunch and break with pizza or sandwiches, working on their own time to help the engineers figure out how to take costs out of product. And so, again, that's that self-directed
concept. And I knew that they were working over the lunchtime because they had pizza all over the drawing.
That's all right. Pizza grease, it doesn't matter, so long as it so long as it works. Yeah. So to conclude, why should somebody go into manufacturing?
Why should they?
Yeah, I mean, aren't there better jobs in cleaner environments?
There are, but what we need to remember is the manufacturer that makes the profit that runs the rest of society. Service doesn't do that.
Right.
Medicine doesn't do that. And I think this country, of course, now too much is done in China. Maybe some of that will change. But a nation that doesn't produce its own equity is not going to survive.
That's a great way to put it. Manufacturing is a wealth generator for a country.
Better put.
And you know, all the service jobs in the world, the hospitality, all those things, it's great. It's wonderful when we want a vacation. And certainly, you know, in this town, they say it's meds and eds, so it's education and medicine, which we all need to be educated, maybe not in some of those places necessarily, but and we all need to have our health care, so to speak, the doctors. But unless we make something, we fail to exist as a viable country. Well, thank you so much for spending this time with me.
Thanks for the opportunity.
I know that our listeners are going to love it because you've lived manufacturing longer than most of us have been alive. And thank you for the 38, 39 years of adding value to MACNE members and our employees, and also for those, you know, those designs that you helped make better. And for really introducing me, I mean, I tell people, and they know they've heard it, that you're my hero. But for to be able to recognize that your dad helped make some of these refrigerators and washing machines and things like that was always exciting for me growing up. So thank you very much.
Very welcome.
So with that, I'm Dave Freund, and this was The Next Page.